This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Russia has been getting aggressive yet again. Earlier this month, it carried out several provocative moves against Norway, a NATO member that shares a border with Russia in the north. Among these moves were repeated acts of extensive electronic jamming of its satellite signals. That's according to Norway's Foreign Intelligence Unit. And it says that this is part of a trend of cyber attacks by Russia against Norway, some of which have occurred during NATO military exercises. We'll hear a report from trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about the prophetic implications of these attacks. We'll also hear from a new voice on this program, one of our newer trumpet writers and a junior at Herbert W. Armstrong College, Nikolai Giliar. He's from the Philippines, and he has a report on the historically strong alliance between the United States and his home country and how the Filipino president is turning his back on that relationship in favor of a stronger relationship with China. It's quite a picture of the changing geopolitics of Asia and of America's diminishing influence in that part of the world, also a very important prophetic trend. And I'll conclude the program by talking about why it's important, no matter what sort of job you've been given, to prove yourself responsible. But we're going to start by talking about real-world economics versus fantasy. As America's presidential politics begin to pick up, Democratic Party candidates are proposing some policies that would require far more money than America has to spend. These might be politically popular ideas right now, but they are fantastical proposals that could never be successfully implemented. The trouble is, they're not as different from the way America has been managing its money for quite some time as they seem to be, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
New York Congressional Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has attracted attention for backing a program called the Green New Deal. Its purpose is to fight climate change by eliminating fossil fuel-powered electricity, closing all coal and natural gas-powered plants, and transitioning the entire economy to 100% renewable energy by the year 2030. To accomplish this utopian task, Ocasio-Cortez has proposed a jobs creation program that would virtually eliminate poverty and guarantee a living wage to every person who wants one. Since the deal lacks specifics, its cost is hard to gauge. But if all its provisions were carried out, the cost would certainly be in excess of $70 trillion, more than the moon landing, the highway system, and the original New Deal combined. Ocasio-Cortez does not like being asked how she would pay for this undertaking. She describes the question as disingenuous in a January 6 interview with Insider, saying critics don't ask such questions about defense spending. She then explained that funds could be raised through deficit spending or spending more money that is received from taxes. You can pay for it by saving costs on expenditures that we're already doing, she explained. You can do it by saving money on military spending. We can pay for it by raising taxes on the rich. We can pay for it with a transaction tax. And we can pay for it with deficit spending. Now, elaborating on her point about deficit spending, Ocasio-Cortez said she was open to something called modern monetary theory, a radical economic concept stating that the government doesn't need to balance the budget because budget surpluses, or spending less than is received in taxes, somehow actually hurt the economy by reducing consumption. This theory asserts that currency is a public monopoly, since the government can always print more money. So the only limit to spending should be concerns about inflation, which is a general increase in prices that happens when the purchasing supply of money is diluted. Now, it's very unlikely that every provision of the Green New Deal will be passed into law. And many condemn Ocasio-Cortez's plan to pay for her programs by either printing money or borrowing trillions of dollars. Yet as radical as it is, modern monetary theory is actually an extreme overt declaration of the way the government has been operating for decades. The government has recorded budget surpluses only 5 times in the past 50 years. It is now over $22 trillion in debt, and the Congressional Budget Office estimates that annual federal deficits will remain an average of $1.2 trillion over the next decade, even without Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal. So when the government prints or borrows money that has not been earned and puts it into circulation, it dilutes the money supply and creates inflation. Current inflation rates are low, below 2%, despite the nation's exorbitant debt. This is largely because the dollar is the world's primary reserve currency, meaning that many governments, institutions, and individuals hold dollars as part of their foreign exchange reserves. Since so much of the nation's debt is being held in reserve, these dollars are not diluting the supply of money in circulation. Yet if America's creditors lose faith in the dollar and start dumping their reserves into circulation, the inflation rate will increase dramatically, making goods and services cost more. This would drive up interest rates since the dollar would be considered a less safe investment, thus making it prohibitively expensive for the government to borrow more money. Despite what proponents of modern monetary theory say, America's current rate of deficit spending is already undermining faith in the dollar as a reserve currency. This is why so many nations are starting to slowly dump their dollar reserves and buy gold. And as the dollar loses its reserve currency status, the U.S. will lose its ability to print and borrow money without experiencing runaway inflation. Decades of budgetary mismanagement will catch up with the nation, allowing other nations to usurp America's position of economic dominance. The late Herbert W. Armstrong predicted that a massive financial crisis in America would be a catalyst prompting the nations of Europe to suddenly unite into a superstate. Specifically, he warned in 1984 that a massive banking crisis in America could suddenly result in triggering European nations to unite as a new world power larger than either the Soviet Union or the United States. Mr. Armstrong based this prediction partly on financial conditions in America, but primarily upon Bible prophecy. A financial crisis that puts the dollar's position as the world reserve currency in jeopardy could trigger runaway inflation and create a crisis that would practically force Europe to unite into a superpower capable of challenging America both economically and militarily. America's $22 trillion debt is actually the biggest threat to its national security. Modern monetary theory is only making this threat more dangerous and leading to America's ultimate economic collapse.
Well, thank you very much for that, Andrew. You know, you started by talking about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being the instigator behind this Green New Deal. And it is really interesting watching this conversation play out within the Democratic Party. I think the Republicans feel like they've finally got an issue that might gain them some traction with voters by just hammering how ridiculous these ideas are. But you do have some of the declared candidates for Democratic president's office who are saying, okay, well, we're not AOC. We're not going to go that far. I'm going to kind of position myself as the fiscally responsible one. And they come across sounding like the voice of reason simply because they're not so far off the rails as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is, but they're still off the rails.
Right. Yeah, it's almost kind of like it almost seems like you could be forgiven for thinking they planned it that way by setting someone up as a foil to give something so extreme that anything less extreme does sound sane. I mean, like I mentioned in the report, they've only had budget surpluses 5 times in the past half a century.
Yeah.
And that was back when there used to be political candidates who'd campaign on getting budget surpluses.
Right.
Now you've got the Trump administration, which is the fiscally conservative Republican administration, is talking about
Fiscally conservative in scare quotes.
Fiscally conservative in scare quotes, because like I mentioned, the Congressional Budget Office is predicting an average of $1.2 trillion deficits a year for the next decade,
right,
which basically means under the Republican administration, we're planning on spending $12 trillion over the next 10 years that we don't have.
Uh-huh.
Now, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says that we need to spend $70 trillion over the next 10 years that we don't have. And so the difference between a fiscal conservative and being off the rails these days is whether you're spending 12 trillion that we don't have or 70 trillion that we don't have. And pretty much every Democratic presidential candidate who's not Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez cuts the difference somewhere. They want to spend more than the 12 trillion that we don't have that Donald Trump wants to spend.
Yeah.
But they think it's crazy to spend 70 trillion that we don't have that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wants to spend.
Right. And for any, I mean, we just don't hear anyone on the scene actually saying, well, we need to get back to managing our money responsibly. I mean, Donald Trump said that he's the king of debt, that he's used debt very responsibly and to good effect, that that's been a major tool that he's been able to use over the course of his business career. And now the way that he's handling the country's money, there is no voice out there that is being taken seriously at all that would suggest that we do anything different than that.
Right. That's what that modern monetary theory gets up to, is it's saying that you just don't even need, let's just stop pretending like we're ever going to balance the budget. I mean, we've, for the past 50 years, we've racked up trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars in debt. I think it was the Eisenhower administration was the last time we actually reduced the debt at all. But it's always been on the, like, well, this is just a step we have to take for now. We will balance it when things get better, and you just keep kicking the can down the road until now you're getting like this new mind of theory is like, said, well, yeah, we're never going to get around to this, so let's just stop pretending.
It seems like the way that investors are looking at this, the way that economists are justifying this type of policy, essentially gets down to the fact that we don't see an alternative to the dollar, that we assume that the dollar is going to maintain this reserve currency status. You mentioned just how many dollars there are out there that are not in circulation simply because people are holding on to them. But that is a risky gamble. That's assuming that's never, ever going to change, and that's just not realistic, is it?
Right. No, not at all, because most nations, Venezuela, Greece, things like that, that spend money like America spends money, do have economic crashes and hyperinflation crises. The only reason America doesn't is that we can borrow money so cheaply. We're borrowing it at like 1 or 2% interest.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only reason we can borrow that cheaply is because we are the reserve currency. 61% of all currency held in reserve and basically national savings accounts are
dollars.
U.S. dollars.
Yeah.
Despite all the problems, that keeps those inflation rates low, allows America to continue borrow money. That's why I've heard it said that the dollar is the worst currency in the world, except for all the other ones.
Right.
Now, I think the closest thing to an alternative to the dollar as far as currencies is the euro, which is about 21%. It is a reserve currency as well, but it's not 61% of all currencies held in reserve. It's like 21%. So only about a third as many euros in reserve as dollars. And the euro crisis with the bailouts Germany is giving Greece and those financial problems keep nations from having enough faith in the euro for it to have that effect of replacing the dollar as a reserve currency. So other nations like Russia and China that are losing faith in the dollar but don't really have much faith in the euro either are starting to buy gold and using gold like a reserve currency like used to be done. And some of them even hoping that if they get enough gold to back their currencies that maybe nations will start holding rubles or yuan as a reserve currency. But that point I mentioned Mr. Armstrong making about that banking crisis in America being what prompts Europe to unite is like right now it's 61% held in dollars, dominant reserve currency. Euro is number two at 21 100%, but I mean, it is the second option. The only reason people don't use it more is because the euro crisis is worse than America's financial crisis.
Right. That prophecy, Gerald Fleury's talked about that being like Mr. Armstrong's most important personal prophecy. It's not directly communicated in Bible prophecy. It's something that it was a conclusion that he drew connecting the dots of several other statements within Bible prophecy. But maybe you can just elaborate on Mr. Fleury and what he's said about Mr. Armstrong.
Yeah, because Mr. Fleury wrote an article entitled "A Bold Warning, America's Economic Collapse." And in that, he cites Mr. Armstrong talking about a prophecy in Revelation 17:12 about 10 nations in Europe combining together into a resurrected Holy Roman Empire, and these 10 nations giving their power and their strength over to this empire. And then there's other prophecies in Hosea and Isaiah about this European empire invading and even conquering the United States. And so he writes a section in there. It's like, he says, "What will cause these nations to unite so forcefully? It is very difficult to unite nations into one mind. It's an incredibly challenging undertaking, but it's going to be done. In fact, it's taking place even before our eyes." Mr. Armstrong had profound insight into specifically forecasting that the catalyst of this dramatic unification would be a massive financial crisis that starts in America and ripples out from there. Some sort of financial crisis he's talking about that causes nations to lose so much faith in the dollar that they do look to the euro or whatever currency Europe is using at the time, kind of like the next reserve currency, and then Europe becomes the new financial superpower, and you've got a flip of the coin.
Yeah, well, we definitely will keep our eyes on these prospects that are increasingly close to actual fulfillment. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about the dangers posed by America's increasing reliance on deficit spending. He's written an article titled "Deficit Spending is Destroying America." You can read that right now on thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Norway has been experiencing a series of cyber attacks from its neighbor to the east, Russia, as we will now hear in this report from Jeremiah Jacques.
The head of Norway's Foreign Intelligence Unit, Lieutenant General Morgan Haga Lund, delivered his annual National Risk Assessment report last week, and one of his main conclusions was that Russia has been carrying out repeated acts of, quote, "extensive electronic jamming" of satellite signals in Norway. Lund said, quote, "This is not only a new challenge for Norwegian and allied training operations. Jamming is also a threat to, among others, civilian air traffic and police and health operations during peacetime." End quote. From there, Lund enumerated multiple incidents that have occurred since 2017 in which global positioning system, or GPS signals, in Norway have been disrupted by cyber attacks originating in Russia. He pointed out that the disruptions have often occurred during military exercises. The most recent of these was last month, when British attack helicopters were drilling in northern Norway to practice various Arctic maneuvers. The Russians apparently disapproved of those drills and disrupted Norway's signals during them. And then it also happened last fall, when part of NATO's Trident Juncture drills were happening there in Norway. This report shows that during some of the jamming incidents, the Russian military simultaneously flew strategic bombers along the Norwegian coast. Lund revealed that during one such incident, 11 Russian bombers flew a mock attack on a Norwegian radar site. These were Su-24 supersonic bombers, and they took off from Russia's Monchgorsk airbase and flew out over the Barents Sea and then abruptly turned and grouped themselves into an attack formation as they zoomed toward the Norwegian town of Vardø. They changed course just before reaching the town, but that's incredibly provocative. And it was happening while Russia was also cyber-attacking Norway's satellite signals, which just compounds the chaos for the officials trying to monitor these kinds of developments. This recent spate of cyber attacks on Norway is alarming, and it's actually part of a broadening and accelerating trend. In recent years, Russia, China, North Korea, and other nations have attacked the computer networks and other cyber technologies of Western nations with increasing frequency and increasing intensity. This strategy is driven largely by the understanding that such computer-based technologies are not only highly relied upon, but they're also highly vulnerable. Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has been warning about this vulnerability for nearly 25 years. He first wrote about it in the mid-1990s, cautioning specifically about the American military's dangerous dependence on computer systems that are vulnerable to sabotage. In our January 1995 issue, he quoted analyst Joseph DeCourcy, who called this dependence, quote, "the Western world's Achilles heel," end quote. So this was an allusion to the mythological Greek demigod who was almost invincible, except for being susceptible to harm just on his heel. And Mr. Fleury wrote, quote, "America is the greatest superpower this world has ever known, but we have a very vulnerable point in our military, our own Achilles heel. It is so dangerous that I'm amazed it hasn't received more publicity," end quote. Mr. Fleury said that examining the Western world's cyber vulnerability brought a certain Bible prophecy into his mind. It's a passage in Ezekiel chapter 7. Verses 1 through 3 of this chapter show that God is speaking here to the land of Israel in the end time. This mainly refers to the United States and Britain in the modern era, and that's something any of the listeners can prove for themselves by studying our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, by Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong. But continuing on here in Ezekiel 7, verse 8 shows that this is describing a time when God punishes these nations for their abominations and for the rejection of his law and his way. Verse 14 details one aspect or one result of that punishment. It says, quote, "They have blown the trumpet, even to make all ready, but none goes to battle." This is the passage that came to mind for Mr. Fleury as he studied into the Western world's cyber vulnerability. In his article, he called this an alarming passage, and he wrote, quote, "It seems everybody is expecting our people, the American people, to go into battle, but the greatest tragedy imaginable occurs. Nobody goes to battle, even though the trumpet is blown. Will it be because of a computer terrorist?" End quote. A passage in Isaiah 59 provides more details related to this future time of chaos. In verses 9 and 10, the people of America and Britain are shown to be stripped of vision. It says, "We wait for light, but behold obscurity. We wait for brightness, but we walk in darkness. We grope for the wall like the blind, and we grope as if we had no eyes. We stumble at noonday as in the night. We are in desolate places as dead men." This is a chilling picture. And this is certainly true in a spiritual way. You can see how the U.S. and the U.K. are in great spiritual blindness. And the vision that is gone here could also include some physical types, like the kind of vision that's provided by satellites, such as those of the GPS system. Russia's cyber assaults on Norway are reminders of the vulnerability of these kinds of systems and of other computer-based technologies. They show that for Norway, for the United States, and for any nation reliant on these technologies, that Achilles heel can be pierced by enemy nations. This new report about the growing threat that Russia poses to Norway is also significant in light of what Bible prophecy says about Europe's role in end-time events. Around 15 years ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin manipulated a major election in a way that tightened his grip on power. At that time, Mr. Flurry wrote that Putin's move and Europe's acute fear of it caused a Bible prophecy to flash into his mind. Mr. Flurry wrote an article at that time, back in 2004, called "Russia Frightens Europe and Fulfills Bible Prophecy." In one section of this article, Mr. Flurry quoted parts of Daniel chapter 11. Verses 40 through 44 of this chapter say, "Tidings out of the east and out of the north will trouble a power called the King of the North." Mr. Flurry explains that this is about modern-day Russia frightening modern-day Europe, or the King of the North, and it's about this fear of Russia being one big factor in the decision of the European nations to militarize and to unite themselves behind a strong leader. Mr. Flurry said, "A combination of historic and current events are leading Europe to do this." He wrote, quote, "Europeans still remember how violent Russia was in World War II, and Russia is a close neighbor with massive piles of nuclear weapons." He continued, writing that Putin's increasingly dictatorial and increasingly militaristic direction will, quote, "hasten the uniting of the European Union and will cause Germany and the other European nations to want a strong leader. Throughout history, Germany has often sought a strong leader. Bible prophecy says it will do so again for the last time." End quote. In 2014, shortly after Putin's Russia had annexed Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, right there in Europe, Mr. Flurry reiterated this same forecast. He wrote, quote, "The fear you see in Europe because of events in Crimea is going to cause 10 leaders in Europe to unite in a sudden and dramatic way, and in precise accordance with the Bible's description of that European empire. Europe's new fear of Russia is going to play a major role in hastening the fulfillment of that prophecy." End quote. And we can see this happening. The fear of Russia that is presently intensifying among leaders in Norway and elsewhere in Europe is causing those nations to work toward unifying Europe politically and militarily. And that's because within a unified European bloc, they feel they can greatly improve their chances of standing up to the expanding Russian threat. Mr. Flurry's 2014 article explains other prophecies recorded in Ezekiel 38, Daniel 2, Daniel 8, and also in the book of Revelation. And he writes that these chapters show that the developments now underway are leading to a time of destruction that will cause more suffering than the world has ever known. But Mr. Flurry also emphasizes that these sobering developments are intimately linked to joyous news. He concludes his article with these very inspiring words. "These prophecies can seem dark and dire, but the Bible tells us that they all have a positive ending. The Messiah will come and stop these disastrous wars. Is this a gloomy message? Well, it does describe a lot of suffering coming upon this world, the worst ever. But it's tied directly to the coming of the Messiah, when all suffering ends and God brings peace, happiness, and joy to the world. That is the best news you could ever hear."
Thank you very much, Jeremiah. So just, I think the points that you made about the cyber warfare and the effect of these moves by Russia on Europe are well taken, very important points to draw from this. I wonder, just backing up at the what Russia was doing exactly in Norway. Why Norway? What is Russia trying to accomplish with these moves?
Well, Norway and Russia share a border there. Norway, actually, it's just a small sliver of it that sort of loops all the way over Sweden and Finland and connects right there to Russia. And a lot of this is happening in the far north, very close to their border. So it's kind of typical for Russia anywhere in its periphery to be pushing against the countries there. It doesn't like, especially NATO exercises. Norway is a NATO member. And so when they allow the British, for example, to bring helicopters in there to practice drills in the Arctic and things like that, that infuriates Russia. Anything that's under the NATO label is you know, viewed as incredibly provocative by the Russians. So it's mostly just because they, you know, they have this expansionistic view. They don't really, they don't seem content with their border anywhere where it is almost. They'd like to see it pushed. And of course, with NATO provocations, they just want to fight back against even routine drills as much as they can.
So did we learn anything about Russia's cyber capability, its cyber warfare capability in what we saw unfold here?
Well, the details of this are apparently haven't yet been published, or they may not be known. So it's fairly scant in terms of exact capabilities. But we do know that the not only military aircraft, but civilian aircraft during these disruptions had to switch to a whole different set of navigation tactics, less reliable, less safe tactics. So normally these planes are all flying with GPS, which is a US-based satellite system, but they had to suddenly switch. And so the authorities say that this is incredibly dangerous. It threatens, you know, civilian rescue operations, police services, things like that. So as for Russia's exact capabilities, it's difficult to say, but it, you know, it makes a big effect however they're doing it.
Any sense of, you know, this is obviously technology that Europe has taken a lot of steps to try to distance itself from, to create its own navigation system so that it's not reliant on an American-based navigational tool like that. Here we have the Norwegian military that's still using GPS, but any sense of, say, how this underlines Europe's need for creating its own kind of tools?
Well, I think we can expect the Europeans to try to wean themselves more and more from American technology. And there have been astounding developments among the Europeans to, you know, launch their own satellites and implement their own navigation systems. There's also an interesting trend happening in which many navies are kind of trying to revert back to ancient navigational practices. You see people returning to at least having a backup plan for sidereal, you know, star-based navigation and things like that. So it's kind of this recognition that dependence on modern technologies is dangerous. So they want to be able to revert back to the way they did it, you know, 1,000 years ago.
Well, it does seem like we're having a conversation along these lines every couple of weeks, where Russia is taking steps to push against its borders. As you mentioned, we had the conversation about Belarus just last Friday,
right,
and just how Russia is seeking to absorb that, and they seem to be somewhat amenable to that, at least the leadership within that country.
Yes,
but yeah, the conflict between these European states and Russia just continues to foment. We appreciate you bringing that to us. We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques about Russia's attacks on Norway, including quite significant cyber attacks. He's written an article, Russia Cyber Attacks Norway. You can read that online at thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much, Jeremiah.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
America's influence in Asia has been declining for some years now. Perhaps nowhere is this reality more obvious than in America's one-time strong ally, the Philippines, as we will now hear in this report from Nikolai Giliar.
The Philippines has been arguably the most pro-American nation on earth. Its history with the United States has stretched for more than a century, with the two suffering and overcoming together and building a strong bond. But as strong as that bond is, it will soon break. In the late 1800s, the U.S. liberated the Philippines from Spanish occupation and soon after colonized it. This marked the first time that the U.S. had deliberately set out to conquer an overseas territory and occupy it. Under American rule, the Philippines flourished. Between 1900s and the 1920s, American investment in health and education led to a doubling of the Filipino population. In just under a generation, literacy increased from 20% to 50%. The American colonizers redistributed land to peasants. They built roads, railways, ports, dams, and irrigation systems to make Filipinos' lives better. Filipinos finally received the freedoms they had long sought under Spain. American journalist and historian Stanley Carnot, known for his writings on the history of the Vietnam War, wrote that, compared to the previous Spaniard colonization, American rule in the Philippines was a model of enlightenment. Filipino historian Samuel Tan, who is known for his anti-American sentiments, agrees with Carnot, describing the American occupation of the Philippines as the historical engine that brought a modicum of modernity to the Filipino masses. One of the most remarkable symbols of a strong alliance between the Philippines and the U.S. was the Mutual Defense Treaty, signed in 1951. One of the oldest security treaties in the Asia-Pacific region, the Mutual Defense Treaty has dissuaded more powerful Asian nations from attempting to pressure or invade the Philippines. The arrangement has also benefited the U.S. as a cornerstone of America's ability to maintain peace and stability in the region. In recent years, however, government officials in the Philippines have started to question the relevance of the Mutual Defense Treaty. On December 28, 2018, Defense Secretary Delfin Lorenzana, a cabinet member known for his pro-American stance, called for a review of the agreement, saying the Philippines should decide whether to maintain the treaty, strengthen it, or scrap it. Lorenzana seemed to suggest that the third of those options may be best. He said, "That's 1951. It's a 67-year-old treaty. Is it still relevant to our national interests?" There was this raging Cold War. There was a Cold War then. Do we still have a Cold War today? Is it still relevant to our security? Perhaps not. Lorenzana's statements parallel comments President Rodrigo Duterte made during a visit to China in October 2016. He said this, "The foreign policy gears now towards here, China. No more American interference. No more American military exercises. China has been a friend of the Philippines, and the roots of our bonds are very deep and not easily severed. Even as we arrive in Beijing, close to winter, this is a springtime of our relationship." From the start of Duterte's presidency, bilateral trade between the Philippines and China has increased. Since 2017, China has become the Philippines' largest trade partner. The Philippines exports more than $600 million worth of trade to China, and it imports almost $2 billion worth of trade from China. Chinese investment has also risen in the Philippines since Duterte became president. With a 67% year-on-year increase, investments from China reached more than $50 million in 2017. In 2018, China more than tripled its investment with over $165 million. China has ramped up its investments in the Philippines, proving that it seeks an alliance. During Chinese President Xi Jinping's state visit to the Philippines last year, he and Duterte signed a Memorandum of Understanding. The agreement, which has a time frame from November 2018 to November 2028, lays out immense Chinese investment on trade and infrastructure in the Philippines under China's Belt and Road Initiative. During Xi's two-day visit, he and Duterte also signed 29 separate deals, including a plan to convert Clark Air Base, one of the largest American bases in Asia during the Cold War, into an offshore center for Chinese technologies. The Chinese state-run company, the Gezoba Group, has agreed to pay $2 billion to build a 500-hectare industrial park there. This commercial center could potentially be turned into a military base. China is also eyeing other former U.S. military bases, such as the Hanjin Shipyard in Subic Bay. Clark Air Base and Subic Bay were two of the largest American military bases in the Philippines before U.S. troops were ousted in 1992. China has expressed strong interest in acquiring these bases. The Philippines and other Asian nations see that America's influence is dwindling and are taking action. recognizing that China's military and economic clout is replacing the U.S. in the region, they are rallying around China. This kind of arrangement would lead to the fulfillment of major Bible prophecies. Ezekiel 38 prophesies of a union of Asian nations led by Russia and China that will play a vital role in the end time. The book of Revelation calls this massive Asian bloc the kings of the east. Revelation 16 verse 12. Revelation 9 verse 16 states that this union of Asian nations will amass a military of 200 million men. Since the Philippines is drawing closer to China, the Philippines could join this Asian bloc with China. The decline of American power is also evident in the Philippines. This is why China is able to reach out to the Philippines and form a partnership. This too was prophesied in the Bible. Following World War II, Plain Truth Editor-in-Chief Herbert W. Armstrong forecast that America would lose the will to use its power and would never again win a war. After America's debacle in sponsoring a failed invasion of Cuba, Mr. Armstrong laid the blame on the American people. In the October 1961 Plain Truth, he wrote, "Unless or until the United States as a whole repents and returns to what has become a hollow slogan on its dollars, in God we trust, the United States of America has won its last war. I said that when we failed to win in Korea. I say it again now that the United States government endorsed this Cuban fiasco. Its president gave the go-ahead, and God, the God America has deserted, gave it its most humiliating defeat. What does the Cuban debacle mean? It means, Mr. and Mrs. United States, that the handwriting is on your wall." Mr. Armstrong's forecast of diminishing American power is based on Bible prophecy. In Leviticus 26, God outlines the blessings ancient Israel and its descendants would receive if they obeyed God, and curses if they disobeyed. Verse 19 states that God will break the pride of Israel's power. One of the modern-day nations descended from ancient Israel is America. A quick look at America's wartime history after World War II shows that God has indeed broken the pride of America's power. The once great superpower that many nations like the Philippines revered has lost the will to defend its allies from nations such as China. This is why the strong bond between the Philippines and the U.S. is certain to break.
Thank you very much for that, Nicolai. I appreciate that. And welcome. Very good job for your first contribution to Trumpet Hour. We appreciate that very much. So you are from the Philippines. You grew up there. And maybe you could just talk a bit about your experience as you're watching this unfold and you're hearing President Duterte say turning away from the United States and toward China. Just how you feel, I guess, having personal experience with just the American presence there and Philippines relations with China before this point.
Yes, I grew up basically admiring America's history with our nation, and I studied into that history and was proud of that history, what America has brought to our country. As I said there in the report, it has improved our nation's economy and other realms in our politics as well, gave us democracy that has the democratic government in Asia. Mm-hmm. And now seeing that President Rodrigo Duterte is realigning our nation's foreign policy toward China, it's a bit sad to hear that, since growing up, I've had that admiration of America. But also at the same time, seeing the logic behind his actions. America has lost the will to defend its allies in the region. And so our president is doing what he can to protect our country. So I also understand how Duterte is also doing the best he can to secure the nation's interests.
Well, yeah, that's a good point. In some ways, he's being boxed in a little bit, and even the support that he has gained from the Filipino people reflects this developing reality. So just talk a bit about China's interest in this, why China would be seeking to loosen America's presence in the region and to develop this kind of relationship with the Philippines?
Well, China fears a U.S. blockade along the first island chain. And part of China's strategy is to basically ally with the Philippines so that it could counter a blockade against the U.S. in the first island chain. And if it could ally with the Philippines in the first island chain, which includes Indonesia, the seas in Indonesia, in the Philippines, all the way to Japan, those islands, if China could ally with the Philippines, and it could use Philippine waters, host territories, sports bases to basically blockade America as well, that could put China in a very significant advantage.
Mm-hmm. So really, we've been following and tracking China's tightening grip over the whole South China Sea. And really, you look at the map and you see where the Philippines sits in relation to that, those waters that it's seeking to control. Very strategically important in terms of controlling trade routes and even for military purposes. The Philippines, you can see how central it would be to being able to secure both sides of that canal. Well, it's an interesting subject. It is sad to see what is happening there, and as you said, what the Philippines is doing really does reflect the changing geopolitical realities that they're up against. We've been talking with trumpet writer Nikolai Giliar about the Philippines turning away from the United States and toward China. He's written an article for thetrumpet.com titled "The Philippines Rejects America and Embraces China." Go check that out on the website. Thank you very much, Nikolai.
You're welcome, sir.
It's time for today's last word.
Her arm was broken, and I felt terrible. I was 19 years old, working at a summer youth camp with kids aged 8 through 12. I was teaching a class we called Imagineering. Using an assortment of ropes, hay bales, tires, poles, and other materials, the campers had built an obstacle course that they navigated on the last day of camp. On one obstacle, this girl had fallen awkwardly, and that ended her camp experience. Now she was being driven off to a clinic. That night, I was really discouraged. I talked to my dad, hoping for something like, "That's okay, accidents happen." Instead, to my dismay, he corrected me. "You have to ensure those campers' safety above everything else," he said strongly. A second session of the camp was beginning within a couple of days. "Figure out a way to put them in safety harnesses or something," he told me. "The parents are counting on you. This simply must be right." That was a tough pill to swallow. But without that correction, I probably would have floundered in self-pity, changed nothing, learned nothing, and perhaps had a repeat experience. Instead, I was forced to accept blame, take responsibility, and fix the problem. My battle in that moment is one I've faced many times since. It is common to anyone trying to accomplish anything worthwhile. It comes from the weight of responsibility. Responsibility is a potent word. It can be used to mean a task or a job, like it's my responsibility to take out the trash. Getting a new responsibility can be a mark of progress and maturity for a young person. A responsibility can be an opportunity, like getting to drive the family car and bringing it home with a full tank. The word can also refer to accountability, a burden, or even blame or guilt. It's her responsibility to finish that project, or he bears responsibility for damaging that vehicle. In a sense, all these things boil down to the fact that when you receive a job or opportunity, you are also held responsible. Others are relying on you. You have to do the job and do it right. Are you responsible? Can people rely on you? Are you dependable? You want opportunity, but do you also accept accountability? Be honest with yourself. Judge your success not by good intentions or wishful thinking, but by actual results. To follow through on a job or a commitment, to be dependable to others, even when you don't feel like it or it's inconvenient, it can be hard to do. It takes character. When God gives someone a responsibility, He wants to see results. Our human nature wants to wiggle out and put up excuses. Moses said, "Well, I'm not good enough." Gideon said, "My family is too lowly." Jeremiah said, "I'm too young." A slothful servant said, "My boss is too harsh." You can find that in Jesus's parable of the talents in Matthew 25. But God does not accept excuses. He wants results. Fundamentally, this is a choice you make. You choose whether you can be relied on or not. It's a matter of the priority you put on it. If your priority is to grow in godly character, you'll take responsibility for yourself. You'll be dependable and trustworthy to others. You'll carry out your commitments. If you don't put a priority on it, you'll get distracted. You'll need reminding. You'll always show up late and hold others up. You'll be unpredictable and unreliable. This will create a lot of problems in your life, in your education, your work, your relationships, your spiritual life, until you correct it. God is training us to be reliable, trustworthy, responsible. We need to think about that with every task we're given. When you're given a job, get it done. See it through, even when it gets hard. Don't intend to see it through. Don't try to see it through. Don't wish you could see it through. See it through. Choose to make success your priority. Work at being dependable. During that second session of summer camp, I rigged all the campers up in safety harnesses. And this actually made it so the obstacles could be more daring, more exciting, and fun. We made it through with no injuries, and I had a real sense of accomplishment and satisfaction. God will give you the help you need if you do your part, but you must do your part, whether it's protecting students on your obstacle course, or finishing that project by the deadline, or proving yourself an attentive, diligent worker. When you're given a job, do it right. Stick with it to the end. And if you're doing this the right way, you will earn a reputation for responsibility. People will be able to count on you, and so will God. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that will do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Miller, Jeremiah Jacques, and Nikolai Giliar. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Marcus Aurelius. Do not indulge in dreams of having what you have not, but reckon up the chief of your blessings you do possess, and then thankfully remember how you would crave for them if they were not yours. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.